We have been slowly moving through the first beatitude of the Sermon on the Mount, poor in spirit. We defined this attitude as an awareness that I am powerless, spiritually bankrupt, helpless, unworthy, and a wretched sinner before God. A personal knowledge that if my life is to be of any value, it will have to be all of God and His mercy. This is the beginning step to empty myself of myself so that God will begin to fill me with His Spirit. Now, in order for us to develop this attitude, we first of all need to see God. When Isaiah saw God in Isaiah chapter 6, he said, "Woe is me, I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips," as he comes face to face with God. But our focus has been on the man Job. Job was described by God as a righteous man. Satan was given permission to try him. His possessions and children were taken away from him, and he himself was afflicted with some illness. His three friends accused him of committing some great sin. Job maintained that he was innocent. However, he, in his heart, did something that was gross. He was trying to bring God down to the human level. Elihu gives an introduction to God by saying, in essence, "How dare you, Job, question God?" His message was preparatory to Job's personal encounter with God. Let's go to Job chapter 38. And again, I'm going to be using the New Living Translation. I think we're probably going to have to turn down the volume on this because I'm putting a mute button on my mouth. I haven't even gotten warmed up yet. So the volume definitely will need to come down on this speaker. Job chapter 38. And I'm going to be using the New Living Translation in verse 1. Job chapter 38, verse 1, it says, "Then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind." God comes down in a whirlwind. Where is Job? According to chapter 2, he is in the ashes. This is the garbage dump where they burn refuse. Now imagine a windstorm in a landfill. Molded bread, windstorm, whack. Maggot infested fruit, windstorm, whack. Rotten tomatoes, windstorm. That he is dealing with here. Now that's possibly what Job is experiencing at this moment. Job has compared himself to God. God wants to show Job that there is no difference between Job and the garbage heap. All right? There is no difference when it comes to comparison to God. Job is a man. God is God. Verse 2, "Who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? Brace yourself, because I have some questions for you, and you must answer them." Now, God doesn't answer Job's charges. God asks him more than 40 simple and incisive questions, introducing all of them with the expression, "Do you know?" or "Were you there?" But Job has no answer. How many times have some of us done similar things? God is trying to speak to us, but we question his wisdom with ignorant words. It's not wrong to question, but once we come to grasp what's going on, we should begin to realize how foolish it is to question what God is doing in our lives. There are three different areas in this section of chapter 38 to 41. First is the earth and the universe. We will spend the majority of the time on that in chapter 38. The second would be the animal creation, and the third would be morality or God's justice, which Job has brought into question about God. We're not going to spend as much time on those two areas in 39 to 41. Let's pick it up then in verse 4. It says, Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you know so much. When the earth was created, where was man? He was not even in existence yet. That's one thing we can agree on. That when the earth came into existence, there was no man. In all of the centuries since, this question was asked of Job, man has never been able to conclusively answer the question of origin. Where did the universe come from? How did it originate? Who brought it into being? The world has been debating this for years, but man has never been able to answer the question about origin of the universe and the earth because he was not there. He was not there to observe what happened. So he theorizes, he hypothesizes, he pasteurizes, and he homogenizes about a big bang, about pea soup, and an electric spark. God says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Here, man comes up with his own idea. In the beginning was the hydrogen atom. Those who believe in God say, where did the hydrogen atom come from? They don't know. But they will turn around and ask, well, where did God come from? Well, we weren't around. Both of these require faith. Which one requires the most? Which one? God says, in the beginning, God. Contrast that with the hydrogen atom. 30 million light years across, reaching critical mass and exploding. Why did it explode? Don't know. In the beginning, God. This explosion was orderly. Have you ever seen an orderly explosion? No? Well, how is it that it happened? Don't know. In the beginning, God. In this orderly explosion, we've got billions of galaxies spun out in symmetrical order. One of them dubbed the Milky Way that has a star in it with 9 orbiting bodies and they're not running into each other. How is that happening? Oh, we can come up with our ideas, but we really don't know. In the beginning, God. Then on one of these planets was this murky substance. Where did this murky substance come from? Don't know. In the beginning, God. Then there was an electrical spark. Where did this spark come from? Don't know. In the beginning, God. But this electrical spark started life. How? I don't understand it. And this life started evolving from a gamete to an amphibian, to a reptile, to a monkanoid, to a humanoid. How? Don't know. In the beginning, God. And the question is, why did we stop at the humanoid? Why hasn't it continued on? Don't know. In the beginning, God. Which requires more faith? It's not this one. It is most definitely this one. Verse 5. It says, do you know how its dimensions were determined and who did the surveying? This wasn't haphazard. The earth has a diameter of 8,000 miles, circumference of 25,000 miles. Those dimensions are exactly necessary for the maintenance of life. Giving you some quotes from a book that one of the books that we were asked to read and purchase when I started attending church, actually before the book came out. The book is entitled Why We Believe in Creation, Not Evolution by Fred Meldow. It's a bit dated, but just read what it says here. We start with the quote now here on the very first quote, verse 28, page 28. The mass and size of the earth are just right. If the earth were 9,500 miles in diameter instead of 8,000 that it is, it would double the weight of the air. With twice as much oxygen, the amount of water would be greatly increased, so much so that the entire surface would be covered with an ocean. Bye-bye, Florida and the rest of the world. If the earth were much lighter than it is, its gravitational pull would be less, so that it would not be able to hold as much air as we now have. The lighter gases would escape first, and heavier gases, like carbon dioxide, would remain. So the combination of gases in the air would be affected, as well as its volume and density. And life as we know it would no longer be possible on Earth. Conditions on Earth would approximate those on the moon. The Earth is just the right distance from the sun relative to the amount of heat and light the sun pours into space. If the Earth were much closer, it would be too hot. If it were much farther away, it would be too cold. If the Earth had been tilted as much as 45 degrees instead of what it is, 23, temperate zones would have torrid zone heat in the summer and frigid zone cold in the winter. On the other hand, if the axis of the earth were vertical, straight up and down, to the plane of its orbit, January and July would have the same climate, and ice would accumulate until much of the continents would be ice-covered 6 months and flooded the other 6 months. If the axis of the earth were horizontal to the plane of its orbit, there would result a crazy jumble of fierce heat and deadly cold, with prolonged nights on half of the earth and prolonged days on the other. The earth rotates at just the right speed, making a complete revolution every 24 hours in its trip around the sun. The result is the earth's crust is evenly heated like a chicken on a turning spit. Were our day a year long, as it is on Mercury, there would be scorching heat on one side, bitter cold on the other. If our day of 24 hours were longer or shorter, all present balanced adjustments would be upset, and life on Earth would become intolerable, if not utterly impossible, in the beginning. God. Verse 6. What supports its foundations and who laid its cornerstone? In other words, how is the earth hanging on nothing? Man in his ignorance theorizes in the past about the earth as floating on the backs of elephants or turtles swimming in the sea. Where is this sea? It's taken us a while to realize the earth is out there on nothing. Try it. Got my pen. Can I just keep it up there on? It goes down. How in the world is the earth hanging on nothing? God asked Job, how did this happen? Only answer science gives is gravity. But what is gravity? What is this invisible force? that we find that has been around long before Newton and the apple? What is this force that we don't see, we don't hear, we don't taste, we don't touch, we don't smell? We can sense it. We step on a scale to weigh ourselves, and we don't like the figure we see. And if we don't, you know what? We can move over to the moon, which has 1/6 of the gravity. So now here, if I am 210 pounds here on good old Earth, I am only a sixth of that on the moon. Wow. That's something. But why do we have this? Why do we find these gravitational forces between the planets? And there is a gravitational pull in our planetary system. Why is it there? The angels saw what God did in verse 7. As the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. In the beginning, God. Then in the next section, God turns to the most prominent feature on the earth, water. If you look at pictures of the earth from space, you will see that 3/4 of the earth is covered in water. We know that water is made up of two invisible gases, hydrogen and oxygen. And when these two gases are combined in the right proportion, a visible substance called water springs into being. What a dramatic moment when God caused these invisible gases to join together in such quantities that an ocean suddenly spread across the planet. Page 37 of Meldow. It says, we all know that a world without water would be lifeless. But a world in which water followed the customary laws of physics would also soon become lifeless. Water has been aptly called the most uncommon of the common substances. What a marvelously versatile substance water is. Its molecules locked together in flinty embrace as ice. And think of all the uses of ice in our economy. In another form, water covers the earth with a dry protective blanket of snow in the winter and piles up ton after ton of stored water in the valleys of the mountains. It falls as rain to quench the thirst of the dry earth in the spring and summer. It feeds our rivers and fills our oceans and lakes. It shades us from the heat of the sun as vapor in the clouds. As steam, it dries powerful machinery. Truly, water is one of the greatest gifts of God to man. Without water, there could be no inhabited earth. Water, unlike any other substance except bismuth, is heaviest at 4 degrees centigrade, slightly above freezing. Above that and below that, it is lighter. Because of this, ice floats and water freezes from the top down. That's a violation of most substances. It freezes from the top down. Above that, or if ice were heavier than water instead of lighter, when a lake froze, the ice would sink and the water would soon be solid from the bottom up. All rivers and lakes would freeze solid. This would kill all fish, prevent thawing in the spring, and so upset the scheme of things as to make life on earth impossible. Who changed the law that cold contracts and heat expands when it applies to water? The Creator designed it so. That ice, when you look at it, is lighter, and it floats in its solid state of water. Most solids are heavier because they contract. When ice now is in its solid state, water is in its solid state, the molecules expand. How do you explain this? In the beginning,
God.
God uses a beautiful analogy in the next verse. As though the ocean suddenly were born, like a baby springing forth from the womb. God is asking Job about it, but Job is ignorant about it, of course. Verse 8. Who defined the boundaries of the sea as it bursts from the womb? And as I clothe it with clouds and thick darkness, page 44 of Mildow. The first miracle in the light of what the rest of the universe is like is that there is an ocean here. In the universe as a whole, liquid water of any kind, sweet or salt, is an exotic rarity. Contrary to common belief, the liquid state is exceptional in nature. Most matter in the universe seems to consist either of flaming gases, as in the stars, or frozen solids drifting in the abyss of space. Only within a hairline band of the immense temperature spectrum of the universe, ranging through millions of degrees, can water manifest itself as liquid. Scientists have wondered and theorized where all the water came from. Most scientists today tell you that the Earth's water came from volcanoes, from water sealed in the heart of the young planet from the beginning. But how could it if the Earth was originally a whirling mass of flame and fire, or a whirling mass of hydrogen gas, as many theorists claim? Most authorities agree that this first great flood of water coming from volcanoes could not have filled the ocean basins as they are filled today, or indeed supplied much more than 20% of the water that now laps high on the continental ramparts. We know that originally the entire world was covered with water, Genesis 1, verse 2. Let me skip down from that. Who made the oceans? The answer is God made them. For an enlightening discussion on this, read Job 38, 1 to 11. Obviously, the very presence of our earth of such vast quantities of water is a special work of the Creator. The second miracle in view of the vast quantity of water there is on the earth is that there is any land area at all. There is full evidence that at one or more times the entire earth was covered with water. We know this because practically everywhere on earth may be found sedimentary rocks containing fossils from the sea. All land area on the earth was once a part of the seafloor that happens now to be sticking out. All authorities admit this planet is mostly sea, and there is nothing really to prevent it being all sea. A little natural leveling of the land would do so. Were we to level off completely the Earth's present land surface, including the bottom of the oceans, the present continental masses would be about a mile and a half under water. Why? Why? In the beginning, God. Verse 10. Says, for I locked it behind barred gates, limiting its shores. Verse 11, I said, thus far and no farther will you come. Here your proud waves must stop. Yet the emphasis of this seems to be on how the ocean is controlled. God said he puts bounds on it and says, thus far and no farther will you come. It's remarkable that the substance that he uses to keep the oceans at bay is one of the most unreliable substances of all, sand. Sand. Beaches of sand hold the oceans in its place. Beaches of sand are what fulfills the statement of God, thus far and no farther will you come. Number of you are from the islands. I have walked the beaches of islands for years. Some of you walk the shores here of Florida, and you know as you create footprints in the sand, here come the waves. All of a sudden, your footprints disappear. Where's the water? Where'd it go? Amazing. In the beginning, God. Then in the next verses, God questions Job on the earth's rotation, producing day and night. Verse 12. Have you ever commanded the morning to appear and caused the dawn to rise in the east? Have you ever told the daylight to spread to the ends of the earth to bring an end to the night's wickedness? Verse 14, for the features of the earth take shape as the light approaches and the dawn is robed in red. The light disturbs the haunts of the wicked, and it stops the arm that is raised in violence. Page 36 of Meldow. Were it not for the dust in the atmosphere in heavens, the heavens would be black. At 17 miles up, the sky is always black, with only a luminous glow from below. To the presence of dust in the atmosphere, we owe almost our sunrise splendors, gorgeous sunsets, and radiant afterglow. Get rid of the dust. We're bathed in darkness like 17 miles up. Why? God says, Job, can you do that? Job now is starting to sink. He's coming back down to earth. Next, God deals with the depths of the ocean. Verse 16. Have you explored the springs from which the seas come? Have you walked about and explored their depths? It's remarkable that we're only now beginning to explore and map out the ocean depths. The secrets of the deep are still hidden to most of us. We can only go down so far. That's it. We might use Diane to go do some scuba diving. But we ain't going down too far. I mean, that goes way, way down. God says, can you walk down there? You get that little machine. You can go down so far. Can you go all the way down to Mariana Trenches? Then he goes into another dimension. Talks about what happens after death. Asking Job, can you understand this? Verse 17, do you know where the gates of death are located? Have you seen the gates of utter gloom? Do you know this transition when you stop respirating and there is no oxygenation going on inside of the lungs any longer? What happens? I mean, here again, we got this faith because most people believe that Uncle Joe and Mama Sue, they're up there in heaven floating around, looking down on us, all poor souls down here on earth. That's where they are. Why haven't they said anything to us? I mean, death has touched every one of us. And there are those who say, yeah, I have heard from Mama Sue and Cousin Billy. Yeah, I've heard from, yeah, right. We haven't heard because in the beginning, God says the dead know not anything. They don't know. Verse 18, do you realize the extent of the earth? Tell me about it if you know. Well, we are in the 21st century and we have explored and mapped out most of it, but not all of it. Thousands of years ago, Job could not answer that question from God. Today, we can board a jet plane in London, stop in New York and have lunch, eat dinner in Los Angeles, and pick up our luggage in Singapore. We have covered the expanse of the earth at last. even though there are still areas we don't know a whole lot about. But how long has it taken us? As God asked him this question, do you know the extent of the earth? Job could mount on a camel, a donkey, or his feet, hop in a boat, and how long would it take him to make it even all the way around the earth? Verse 19, where does the light come from? Where does the darkness go? Can you take it to its home? Do you know how to get there? But of course you know all of this, for you were born before it all was created, and you are so very experienced. God uses a bit of irony here on Job. What he is asking Job is basically, do you understand how light is produced? Its origin? This might be our last quote here from Mel Dow, page 30. The sun rays are miracles that science seeks to explain. When we ask what light is, we face a problem that has baffled the wisest, most learned scientists for generations, and still does. The ancient Greeks thought that light consisted of minute particles radiating from the sun. The physicists of 50 years ago theorized that light was a series of waves in an all-pervasive material called ether. Today, the electromagnetic theory is advocated, and light is regarded as waves or bunches of particles. So the current theory combines particles and waves, photons, the energy release when an electron jumps from one orbit into another. Hydrogen to helium get together in bunches and form electromagnetic waves, which is light. Understand the theory? Don't worry. No one else does either. That light from the sun could travel 93 million miles at 186,280 miles per second and reach us in a perfect state as true light is a miracle that none less than an infinite creator can achieve. In the beginning, God. Verse 22, he says, have you visited the treasuries of the snow? Have you seen where the hail is made and stored? I have reserved it for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. Now, if you've been around up north and in snow, some of you from Ohio, some of you from New England, we've got Jerry from Canada. You are familiar with snow. And you've heard the expression over and over again, no two snowflakes are alike. You ever go out there and look at snowfall? I mean, it's pouring down and you're looking at that. I'm not concerned about whether two snowflakes are alike. I'm thinking about shoveling a driveway. But you look at snow and you try to catch it and see. I mean, these are billions of snowflakes. Billions of them. And no two snowflakes are alike. Amazing. But God says here, I have reserved hail for the time of trouble. That time of trouble is usually referring to the last days. The time of Jacob's trouble, when the great tribulation will occur. He says, I have hidden hail, Job. Do you understand that? Look up. Do you see it? Clear day out there today, huh? You see where he's got the hail stored? Look all you want to. This is God in the beginning. It's God. All these questions are coming at Job one after another. Again, I said, he's starting to sink. He's starting to sink. Verse 24. Where is the path to the origin of light? Where is the home of the east wind? Who created a channel for the torrents of rain? Who laid out the path for the lightning? Who makes the rain fall on barren land in a desert where no one lives? Who sends the rain that satisfies the parched ground and makes the tender grass spring up? Does the rain have a father? Where does dew come from? Here God is examining the forces in a storm. As he says, can you understand this, Job? It's amazing how much is revealed here that we have painfully worked out over thousands of years of scientific study of what God says in the beginning. God speaks about the desert. Who takes care of it? The only answer is God does. Who in the world thinks about the desert? Anybody's concerned about what's going on in the Sahara? The Gobi, the Arabian? Just that I don't want to be there. I'm more concerned about my own front yard becoming a desert, let alone the Sahara desert that is growing. He says, who takes care of the desert? In the beginning, God. Verse 29. Who is the mother of the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from heavens? From the heavens? For the water turns to ice as hard as rock, and the surface of the water freezes. Who understands the process by which ice is formed? We see it happen, but nobody has ever been able to answer that question, why water, when it freezes, does something hardly any other substance will do. Instead of contracting like normal substances, water expands when it freezes. That simple fact makes life possible on this earth. If it followed the natural progression of contracting, life on this earth would cease to exist. How, pray tell, then, Job, does it happen? You can see that it does. You can see that water does indeed expand when it becomes solid as ice. How? How does it violate the laws of science? It's for a very important purpose, Job, so that you can stay there in the garbage heap and try to compare yourself to me. In the beginning, God. Verse 31. Can you hold back the movements of the stars? Are you able to restrain the Pleiades or Orion? Can you ensure the proper sequence of the seasons or guide the constellation of the bear with her cubs across the heavens? Do you know the laws of the universe and how God rules the earth? Even though man has discovered many of the mysteries mentioned, gravity, Earth's rotation, deep trenches, the zodiac, astronomy, it hasn't humbled him as it should. It's given him a deified opinion of himself. It's as if Newton hadn't come along, there would be no gravity. As if Ben Franklin wasn't out there flying a kite, there would be no electricity. And Galileo couldn't come on the scene, the earth would still be flat. The more you study science, and I've brought this out before, the more you study science, the more it should dwarf you by comparison to God. Because we are nothing, nothing compared to him. Verse 34, can you shout to the clouds and make it rain? Can you make lightning appear and cause it to strike as you direct it? Who gives intuition and instinct? Who is wise enough to count all the clouds? Who can tilt the water jars of heaven, turning the dry dust to clumps of mud? When you have a drought and you desperately need rain, who can say to the heavens, rain? I mean, we can put up our planes and try to silver iodide or whatever and see clouds. How did we first of all get the cloud there in the first place? I mean, we got the hydrological cycle, you know, rain's on the water, and the sun is supposed to now cause this water to evaporate up into the sky, and then it condenses into the cloud. What happens if that doesn't happen? God is teaching him some very important lessons about science, how impotent man is. Now God turns his care to the animal world. Verse 39, can you stalk prey for a lioness and satisfy the young lion's appetite? Before I go on with this, as it says here, as they lie in their dens and crouch in the thicket. It's just amazing how he even did that with the male and the female lion. It's the female that does the hunting. It's the male with that big old mane. He just lies there through the day, you know. He's got his bevy of lioness. They keep him satisfied. Hoo-wee. And then he just waits for them to go out and hunt. And once they hunt, then he comes and eats. We had one of our first preteen camps up in Pennsylvania in United back in the 90s. And as an activity, we decided to go to this park, this zoo. And as we were walking around, we had one mother had her baby in a stroller, and we passed by the lion encampment. And it was the lioness that was against the fence. And she was eyeballing the baby in the stroller. Why did God do that? That's the weakest link. Interesting, when you look at these National Geographic channels, these animals of prey go after which ones? These are animals of prey, predators. They are there that if this deer is sick and it is straggling behind, they will eat it and clear it up the earth so that it does not impact me. In the beginning, God. Verse 41, who provides food for the ravens when their young cry out to God as they wander about in hunger? What do you think we would do if God suddenly gave us as human beings responsibility to feed all of the animals of the world, as well as ourselves? I mean, we have a problem today in this country with the welfare system. Can you imagine how much worse it would be if we had to take care of all the animals and the animals are now lined up for food stamps? Can you see them out there shivering in Washington, D.C., dying of starvation, waiting for the government red tape to end so that they can get something to eat? God says, can you handle this, Job? I take care of these animals. You can't do it. I do. Yet they have existed for centuries. And then he goes into the obstetrical care of the animals. Chapter 39. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Have you watched as the wild deer are born? Do you know how many months they carry their young? Are you aware of the time of their delivery? They crouch down to give birth to their young and deliver their offspring. Their young grow up in the open fields. They leave their parents and never return. Can you handle that, Job? You've got an HMO plan for the animal world to take care of them during the birthing process? Job, probably shaking his head. Wow. Verse 5, who makes the wild donkey wild? I have placed it in the wilderness. Its home is the wasteland. It hates the noise of the city, and it has no driver to shout at it. The mountains are its pasture land, where it searches for every blade of grass. Who made animals to have these distinctive natures, be driven by such powerful instincts that they will invariably do what they've been made to do? Who gave them those instincts? Beaver to build the dam. Who gave it? A woodpecker. Try it. If you've got any brains left, you would stop. In the beginning, God. Verse 9. Will the wild ox consent to being tamed? Will it stay in your stall? Can you hitch a wild ox to a plow? Will it plow a field for you? Since it is so strong, can you trust it? Can you go away and trust the ox to do your work? Can you rely on it to return, bringing your grain to the threshing floor? The untamable nature of animals, certain animals, something that God alone can only deal with. And as we talked about this in Where Is God Is Winter, we can put this in quotes, the quote-unquote stupidity of the ostrich. Verse 13, the ostrich flaps her wings grandly, but they are no match for the feathers of the stork. First of all, she flaps them, but she ain't getting off the ground. She'll just flapping. Wow! No match for the stork. She lays her eggs on the top of the earth, letting them be warmed in the dust. She doesn't even worry that a foot might crush them or that wild animals might destroy them. She is harsh toward her young, as if they were not her own. She is unconcerned though they die, for God has deprived her of wisdom. He has given her no understanding. But whenever she jumps up to run, she passes the swiftest horse with its rider. Now on that side, boy, that's positive. This ostrich can outrun the horse. However, it is so stupid. Lays its egg, walks away from it, and probably, I think I gave birth to something the other day. Where is that? There's an egg someplace? Oh, well, so be it. And leaves it. Who made it that way? God says, I did. Why? Was that to be an object lesson for mankind? To show mankind you don't give birth to a child and let it be. That you have a responsibility to care for that child. In the beginning, God. Verse 19. Have you given the horse its strength or clothed its neck with a flowing mane? Did you give it the ability to leap forward like a locust? Its majestic snorting is something to hear. It paws the earth and rejoices in its strength. When it charges it to war, it is unafraid. It does not run from the sword. The arrows rattle against it, and the spear and javelin flash. Fiercely it paws the ground and rushes forward into battle when the trumpet blows. It snorts at the sound of the bugle. It senses the battle, even at a distance. It quivers at the noise of the battle and the shout of the captain's command. All of this, what he is saying, you take this horse in battle. You sound the alarm.
Blow the trumpet. Dun, 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 dun. Charge. Why doesn't this animal retreat? I mean, most animals blow a trumpet. That animal's going the opposite direction. This horse charges. Verse 26. Are you the one who makes the hawk soar, spread its wings to the south? Is it at your command that the eagle rises to the heights to make its nest? It lives on the cliffs, making its home on a distant rocky crag. From there it hunts its prey, keeping watch with piercing eyes. Its nestlings gulp down blood, for it feeds on the carcass of the slaughtered. Chapter 40. Then the Lord said to Job, do you still want to argue with me? Argue with the Almighty? You are God's critic, but do you have the answers? Now we've got the first response from Job at this. Job replied to the Lord, I am nothing. How could I ever find the answers? I will put my hand over my mouth in silence. I have said too much already. I have nothing more to say. In one of the popular TV programs, game shows, Family Feud, the family would say, good answer. Good answer. Job is silenced by this display of God's creation and wisdom. What Job says, basically, I see that I'm not in the same league as you are, God. I'm small potatoes. But so far, he has only been silenced. Unfortunately, he hasn't been humbled. That's why God goes forward. Why doesn't God just stop right there? He realizes he's not in the same league as God. God wants Job to understand something. Not only how great God is, but how much he is nothing by comparison to God. Verse 6, then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind again. Brace yourself. I'm not done with you. Because I have some questions for you. And you must answer them. Are you going to discredit my justice and condemn me so you can say you are right? Job has already admitted that he is not in God's league when it comes to understanding the creation and the caring of the animals. Now God turns to the moral realm, which Job has already come into question earlier, that if he were in charge, he wouldn't do it the way God is doing it now. So God says, are you accusing me of being unjust and unfair? This next section, he invites Job to sit on his throne, sit on the throne of God, and solve the problems that God has to face. Verse 9, are you as strong as God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? All right then. Put on your robes of state, your majesty and splendor. Give vent to your anger. Let it overflow against the proud. Humiliate the proud with a glance. Walk on the wicked where they stand. Bury them in the dust. Imprison them in the world of the dead. Then even I would praise you, for your own strength would save you. God says to him, can you sound like me? Can you act like me? Can you clothe yourself in majesty and administer justice like I do? Is that possible, Job, to be able to handle the proud? And now God is putting his finger on Job's problem. The problem of his arrogance. Not a matter of him comparing himself to other human beings. He's comparing himself to God. How dare you? How dare you? There is a problem in your heart, Job. That heart needs to be humbled.
Can you handle the proud like I do? Can you humble the proud like I do? What would you do if you were in my position and were dealing with a person like you? Then he moves into the area of two amazing animals. Behemoth, a land animal. Leviathan, a sea creature. We've gone to great lengths trying to identify these two creatures. Some have tended to look at them as possibly the hippo, the hippopotamus, or rhinoceros, the elephant being Behemoth. Others look at Leviathan as the crocodile. Some tend to think it might even be a big whale. But they show that only God can deal with the proud human who is full of himself. Verse 19, it is a prime example of God's amazing handiwork. Only its creator can threaten it. You want to go over here to the Everglades, and I hear examples of crocodile hunters, alligator hunters, the rest. You want to go out there and nestle yourself up with an alligator, 10, 12-foot gator? I mean, even gator goes after the python, and the python squeezes it to death but tries to swallow it, and the gator comes back to life and busts the python. You want to fool with that critter? You know what? It's been many, many years seeing my first gator in the States, living up in Orlando at the time. But thankfully, it was in a shop called Gatorland. I'm not looking for a gator out in the wild. Some can handle it. Great. Wonderful. You deal with some of these creatures. Most of us normal human beings, we can't. God says, I do. As well as Leviathan. Chapter 41, verse 34, of all the creatures, it is the proudest. It is the king of the beasts. Back up to verse 10, and since no one dares to disturb the crocodile, who would dare to stand up to me? Who will confront me and remain safe? Everything under heaven is mine. I don't know if it was in Australia, it was this week or a week before. There was a croc where a guy was out there mowing the grass, and the croc decided he wanted to take control of the lawnmower, took the lawnmower and flipped it right on back into its little watered area. And so people were taking pictures, and nobody wanted to go down there and deal with the lawnmower. You know, the lawnmower was staying put. So they had to lure the croc out of that pit someplace else. Then they ran in, because the thing was about 15 feet, ran in and get the lawnmower out. God says, you are that fearful of the croc and you're not that fearful of me? He says, you belong to me. I created you. You are part of my creation. And I am giving you an opportunity to become my child because of my love. Greatest proof of his existence should be what he is doing in my life. And that's what is brought out as we will deal with it in the book of Ephesians chapter 2 beginning next time. So who are we to question God? Who? Chapter 42. Verse 1, Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do anything and no one can stop you. His first reaction is a new view of God. And he points out this again, the first part of verse 2, God, you're omnipotent. I'm not in the same league as you are. He understands that. But he also recognizes the sovereignty of God. No one can stop you. You're not only almighty,
but all that you do is right. That's your character. It does not change. I can only see myself now. How frail I am, how much of nothing I am, when I am able to see you. The more we see God, the less we become. And realizing the need, if there is anything to happen with this mass of clay, it starts with you, it ends with you. And so verse 3, you ask, who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorance? It is I. And I was talking about things I did not understand, things far too wonderful for me. Stephen Hawking turns 70, brilliant physicist who has plumbed the depths of the universe. And now he comes out and says one of the greatest mysteries to him of all, more so than the mysteries of the universe, is a woman. He can't even understand. He can go out here and try to solve things in the universe, but what about a woman? Job has come to a point that all of us must come to. I talk about things I don't understand, things too wonderful for me. What I don't know about God far exceeds what I do. If I were to just take the Bible and just start off, in the beginning, God, and stop right there. The rest of the Bible is what I don't know about this being God. And yet I want to try to bring him down here to my level. Job says, verse 4, you said, listen, and I will speak. I have some questions for you, and you must answer them. I had heard about you before, but now I have seen you with my own eyes. I take back everything I said. I sit here in the garbage heap, in dust and in ashes, to show my repentance. That's repentance, as he melts into nothingness because he realizes that he is nothing before God. There was a piece that we were given back in the Ministerial Refreshing Program back in the 80s entitled When a Man Comes to Himself. And the first section goes this way. It is a very wholesome and regenerating change which a man undergoes when he comes to himself. It is not only after periods of recklessness and infatuation, like the prodigal son, when he has played the spendthrift or the fool, that a man comes to himself. He comes to himself after experiences of which he alone may be aware. When he has left off being wholly preoccupied with his own powers and interests and with every petty plan that centers in himself. When he has cleared his eyes to see the world as it is and his own true place and function in it. It is a process of disillusionment. The scales have fallen away. He sees himself soberly and knows under what conditions his powers must act, as well as what his powers are. Disillusionment, trials, tests are to show us God. And as we see him, we melt into nothing. Job has never been in this place before. He is learning at last the hardest lesson of life, what God seeks to teach all of us, the problem isn't in others. The problem isn't in my boss. The problem isn't in my mate. The problem isn't in God. The problem is in me. It's in me. And it is as that problem is recognized and there is a sense of helplessness, I turn to the only one that can, and that is God. And so Christ starts this series of messages to his citizens in the kingdom, the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit, the men and women who are bankrupt of self, who are nothing, and who recognizes that if anything is to come of this existence, God must be the one responsible. God is God. I am man. There's no comparison. We'll deal with that with the remainder of the Sermon on the Mount. But I'm going to conclude this over here in Romans chapter 11. And we'll take about a 15-minute break at the conclusion of service before the Bible study. But we'll conclude over here in Romans 11, verses 33-36. Romans 11, verses 33-36. Paul says, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has become his counselor? Or who has first given to him and it shall be repaid to him? For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever and ever. All human beings on earth should just say, amen.